I want to welcome you to the Retro Rogues Live podcast. This is a segment from last week's live video show. You can find either one of the live video shows on either Thursday at 7 p.m. or Sundays at 12:05. And now, on with the show.
I want to welcome you to the Retro Rogues Live. Please pay attention to our warning graphic. The Retro Rogues Live show is intended for an adult audience and not intended for children under the age of 13. Parental discretion is advised. So I want you to pay special attention that parental discretion is advised, because we are going to be talking about Revelation a little bit later in today's show. Our main focus is going to be talking about actually the Master Universe film, and we're also going to be talking about the sequel for District 9. This is episode 142 of the Retro Rogues Live. My name is Dave Beta. I'm one of your hosts. For nearly the last 30 years, I've been a professional illustrator and graphic designer. Worked on a lot of fun projects some people have heard of, such as Batman Incorporated, Justice League of America, and even Superboy and the Legion of Superheroes. And once upon a time, Scott Clark and I actually pitched for us to work on the Masters of the Universe relaunch comic over at DC. But enough about that, and welcome back to my co-host. This is Mr. Eric Alexander. Eric, please tell the folks, hopefully watching or listening at home, some of the fun things you have worked on as a creative professional.
Yes, hello everyone. I'm Eric Alexander, also known as Bass God 14. That's Bass God 14, not Bass God. That's Bass God like a bass guitar. And I am the co-host of the Retro Rogues Live. I'm also the chief financial officer of Bad Bob Productions. I recently actually got some good news for the Bad Bob family. So anybody who might be aware of the situation, we do get some good news over at Bad Bob Productions. Currently an executive producer on a film called Staycation, which just filmed another segment in California today.
Very cool. Very cool. Glad to hear about that good news. And let me just start off by saying, I must possess all, or I possess nothing. So we are going to be talking about Masters of the Universe from 1987. This is one of my favorite films. I'm not going to say it's a guilty pleasure, but I've always enjoyed this film. And I've said before on this show, and I'm going to state it again, I have always viewed the Dolph Lundgren, Frank Langella film as the way the Masters of the Universe story ends. And I'm going to get a little bit further into that once we get to the spoiler discussion part of our Rogues retrospective. So you may ask yourself, you're doing a Rogues retrospective. What is that? Okay, well, what a Rogues retrospective is, we want to talk about how we first heard about the film. We want to talk about how we felt about the film when it came out. And we want to talk about how we feel about the film today, having recently revisited it in the light of what's happening right now with the Masters Universe brand. And that's a very important distinction that I want to put out there here at the top of the show. We want to encourage you, please comment from wherever you are. We're going to start off by talking about how we first heard about this film, and we want to hear how you heard about it too. Please comment from wherever you are. It doesn't matter if it's YouTube, Twitch, Twitter. Put your comment right there in the comment section. We'll put your comments up live on the show, as long as they actually pertain, obviously, to our topic.
Eric, we do have our first comment. We do have our first comment here, Dave. I just want to acknowledge Matthew Reed. He said, good morning, gents. Matthew, this is kind of funny because someone was just talking to me about you, Matthew. I think you know who I'm talking about. That's what's the good news I was referring to earlier. But hey, Matthew, thank you for checking us out today.
Very cool. All right. So I'm going to do a quick summary here coming from IMDb, and then we'll get right into it. So the heroic warrior He-Man battles against the evil Lord Skeletor and his armies of darkness for control of Castle Grayskull. Tell me, Eric, how did you first hear about Masters of the Universe?
Well, I was a He-Man fan growing up, so I did watch the Filmation cartoon. I also had a somewhat decent collection of some of the older He-Man figures, some of the more original ones, like, you know, Wave 1, you might call it. You know, I had a decent collection of those. I didn't get much past that, by the way, into some of the, you know, the more, I guess, the more recent figures, which is kind of a very relative term when you're talking about vintage He-Man figures. But I was definitely a fan of the show and definitely had some of the figures. I even had Skeletor's, Panther, you know, the Purple Panther. I had a fairly decent collection of He-Man stuff. So, you know, growing up, I was into it. Maybe not as much as, like, you know, G.I. Joe and Transformers, which were really my kind of staples growing up, but definitely was a fan and definitely enjoyed the cartoon. And I also enjoyed the spinoff. I enjoyed She-Ra. I used to actually watch that quite a bit as well as a kid. So all this stuff was going on, you know, at the time. And then, you know, I just sort of heard about the fact that they were doing a live action version of this. And I was pretty young when this movie came out. You know, I was still basically a kid. But, you know, eventually I went to my dad and said, hey, I want to go see this movie. And he took it to me. So I actually saw this movie in the theater.
All right. Very cool. Now, I also did see this in the theater as well. We're going to shout out the cast here and the crew just a little bit. This was directed by Gary Goddard. The writers were David O'Dell, Stephen Tolkien, and Gary Goddard also has a rewrite on this. Main cast, of course, is Dolph Lundgren as He-Man, Frank Langella as Skeletor, one of my favorite villain performances of all time, Meg Foster as Eva Lynn, Billy Barty as Gwildor, Courtney Cox as Julie Winston, Robert Duncan McNeil, which a lot of people might know actually from Star Trek Voyager, is Kevin Corrigan, and the great John Cypher actually plays Duncan, a.k.a. the Man-at-Arms. Now, let me just talk a little bit about my history with He-Man here just real quickly and talk about how I first heard about the film. The first inkling of anything I ever saw of He-Man, we were actually at... I talked about this before. It was kind of weird that Service Merchandise, which was a retailer in the Mid-South area, would sometimes have toys, and it seemed like they sometimes got toys before other places. For example, I talked about in order to get the Constructicons, I actually had to go to Service Merchandise to get a full set of them because it seemed like that was the only place that had them. So I remembered I was with my parents. We were shopping for something, and there was a display of the Masters Universe action figures, and all the pegs were full, and they had the first line of toys, and it just looked really great fantasy artwork. You know, I liked the Arnold Conan film, and that had led me down the road actually reading some of the Conan comics. Actually, one of my favorite Conan stories actually is a What If Marvel comic, and it's What If Thor Met Conan, which is a really, really great comic. I highly, highly recommend it. So I saw this display and I was looking at all these action figures. And at that time, it was just the main line. So you had the original toys. So you had He-Man, Skeletor, Man-at-Arms, and Beast-Man. That was the original release. And when I looked at them, I thought they were really cool and I wanted to get one. I asked my mom. And so she's like, okay, well, you can get one. And the first Masters Universe action figure I bought, everybody, Man-at-Arms. I have always had a love of science fiction. I love knights. I've talked about my love of samurai culture, and I just love armor and swords and weapons, and I love sci-fi stuff, and Man-at-Arms really appealed to me. So I remember we were actually, shortly after that, we actually went and visited with some family. So we didn't actually go home. I think we were going on a trip. And I remember playing with Man-at-Arms by himself with some of my other action figures. And it's interesting, he came through a time portal in my little storyline I created in my head. And so I remember playing with him, and I loved the little mini comic that came with it. And the mini comic is the first one that's kind of more like a storybook than necessarily a comic book. And I love that to this day. I still feel like the artwork in that by Alfredo Arcala is some of the best fantasy artwork I have ever seen in my life. Just beautiful, beautiful stuff. And in this one, and here's another important distinction to think about, everybody. In this one, He-Man was not Prince Adam from Eternia. He was actually a barbarian from a barbarian tribe, and he went out to seek adventure and fortune, and he stumbled upon the sorceress who was living in a cave, and she gave him his weapons of power, and he went and fought Skeletor. It was a very, very different story, and then Skeletor was not actually from Eternia. He was actually from somewhere else, and apparently doing experimentation in Castle Grayskull, they had sucked him out of his planet or his universe, his multiverse, whatever that is, into Eternia. So it was a very different story from any version of this that we've ever seen as far as adaptations where animated live action doesn't matter. The first thing I ever remember hearing about this movie, though, Eric, was actually an ad for you to win a role to be in the Masters Universe movie. That is the first time I ever heard anything about this movie. There was an ad that was running in comic books, or maybe it was somehow, I don't remember where I saw it, but I just remember the first time I ever heard about them making a Masters of the Universe movie, they were running an ad, and the ad said that you could win a role and actually be a part of Masters Universe. They wanted, you know, kids to fill out the little entry form and send them in, you know, that whole type of deal for a chance to win a part in the movie. And that person is actually in this film. I don't remember his name. He's a little little makeup pig guy, and Skeletor keeps handing him his Havoc staff. If you're watching the movie, he's the guy who's always holding the Havoc staff. It seems like half the time for Skeletor, you blink and you miss him, but he's there.
Really?
Yep. Yep. So that's how I first heard about the Master Universe film. All right. So we talked about how we first heard about it. I want to encourage you again, if you're in the Rogues Gallery, if you're watching the show, please comment from wherever you are. Tell us how you first heard about the Masters Universe movie. We would like to know how you first heard about it. All right, so let's go ahead and get further into this. Eric, you said that you saw this film originally in theaters. I also saw this film originally in theaters. What did you think about the film when you originally saw it?
It was an interesting experience. And again, I was pretty young when this movie came out. But I do distinctly remember, you know, going to the theater. I remember, you know, as a kid, how ominous I thought the beginning was, the intro, when you first get to see the film version of Castle Grayskull, which is very different than the version they had in the Filmation cartoon or the playset for that matter. It was really kind of freaky looking. You know, like maybe something very much out of like, you know, out of the Dark Crystal. You know, I think that's something that I think, you know, kind of goes through my mind. And I just remember how ominous the beginning was as a kid. And I was kind of like, you know, not sure exactly what this was going to be or anything like that. And then, of course, you know, just the way that the film progressed, it definitely was not what I expected. There's just no doubt about it. And, you know, that's part of the, I guess, the controversy with this film, because for a lot of people, this was not what they necessarily expected. If you were used to the Filmation cartoon, this film was really different. And that's what I was used to. You know, I did have some of the comics that came with the figures. You know, I think it is important to remember continuity, obviously, because that is a different continuity than, you know, anything else in He-Man, that, you know, the comic, the mini comics that the figures came with. So I was kind of aware, I guess, even as a kid, that there were sort of like different interpretations of He-Man, if you will. And I quickly kind of realized that this was going to be sort of a different interpretation of He-Man. You know, it wasn't going to be a straight adaptation of the cartoon that I was used to. That said, once I kind of settled in, you know, into the end of the film, I really started to enjoy it. One of the things I really liked was Skeletor's soldiers in this movie. And I remember just the design, and, you know, they're actually very evocative of like the Death Star gunner from Star Wars. And I've always enjoyed that design, that crazy helmet and everything like that. And I remember being really taken aback. Because, you know, in the Filmation cartoon, Skeletor's soldiers were these really goofy-looking robots. I don't know if you remember that, Dave. I'm sure you do. But in the cartoon, you know, Skeletor had these really goofy-looking robots, and they were like his army, you know, in addition to his henchmen, right? And I remember this was a real step up in my mind. Like, as a kid, I was like, these guys look cool. You know, their guns look cool. They look cool. They moved really good. You know, which was kind of interesting. Like, one of the things that really struck out to me is, like, for instance, stormtroopers, you know, up to that era, right? You know, in the original Star Wars trilogy, they were always a little bit kind of on the bulky side, a little bit awkward. But these guys did really dynamic stuff, the Skeletor soldiers in this movie. And I remember being so impressed with so many of the action sequences, because they would be like breaking through windows. One of the things I really liked that, you know, is that they would move, you know what I mean? Like they would get down on their, you know, get down on their stomach to try to cover themselves if they were out in the open. Really dynamic. And I remember just being really taken aback by that. Of course, there were other things that were new that I was a little bit, you know, I was a little bit upset about, you know, I didn't feel like it was accurate, you know, that it was really what, you know, the world of He wasn't one of them. I thought Dolph Lundgren actually looked really good as He-Man. I never had a problem with his performance, even as a kid. You know, I enjoyed that, and I thought he had a great physique and all that kind of stuff, and a great presence and all that kind of stuff. And I thought, you know, as a kid, I thought he was a good He-Man as a kid. Ironically, the one that really stuck out to me, you know, even as a kid, and I remember even as a kid thinking this, was Teela's outfit. Teela's outfit really got me as it, because I had the Teela action figure. Boy, did I have that Teela action figure. And also the Sorceress. I remember also the Sorceress, even as a kid, really stuck out to me. I wasn't digging the redesign of the Sorceress. So it's kind of funny, especially in the environment we are now, because those female characters really stuck out to me as like, that's not really what they look like. But in contrast, I thought the way they did Man at Arms, you know, Dave, you were mentioning that Man at Arms is a really popular character for you as a kid. I really dug what they did with Man at Arms. I remember that as a kid distinctly saying, wow, Man at Arms looks really cool. And he kind of looks like the guy, he looked like the cartoon to me, you know, the actor and everything like that, who I didn't even know anything about. You know, I wasn't watching Hill Street Blues or anything like that when I was a kid. That was, you know, too edgy or, you know, too adult for me at the time. But I was really impressed with his armor. Like a lot of people, I think at the time as a kid, I was disappointed there was no Orko. And I kind of did see the similarities, you know, of what they did, you know, as far as what I consider a little bit of an Orko ripoff, you know, even at the time. But I eventually kind of warmed up to it. And, you know, by the end of the movie, as a kid, I remember actually feeling like this was fun. You know, I enjoyed this. I had my issues with it. You know, I didn't think it was perfect, but, you know, because I felt like it wasn't, you know, quote unquote, like maybe faithful enough to the source material, even as a kid. But I really remember enjoying it and having a good time. And I felt like my dad did too, which is, you know, interesting too, because my dad wasn't like a big He-Man fan or anything like that. You know, He-Man was definitely not something that was really on his radar. He was just taking me. And, you know, at the end of the film, I think we both came out, you know, enjoying it. You know, what about you, Dave?
Well, I saw this in theaters as did you, Eric. I was a little bit older. And for me, initially, for some reason, and I've never quite understood why my mind did this, but when I originally saw this, as soon as the film starts and Skeletor's got these new, essentially stormtroopers, right? He comes storming into the castle, Castle Grayskull with Evil Lyn. Clearly, they've won. Something's been going on and they've won. And because of how different everything was, I just took it as this is many, many years after the Filmation cartoon. A lot of the characters we're not seeing have probably died in battle, because they show us a lot of people who are Eternian soldiers and stuff that are dead. We see vehicles that are crashed. And in my mind's eye, I just assume were things like, you know, Wind Raiders and stuff. And so I just immediately took that this film as, oh, they're going to tell us that this is how the story ends. Like this is the final battle. That's what this movie represents. And then when I saw He-Man, I just immediately assumed that he had told everyone that he was Adam and stopped being Adam, and he was just He-Man all the time. And that Skeletor had managed to ramp up his forces. Maybe he'd gone in league with someone and betrayed them, and that's where the Stormtrooper soldiers came from. I just, in my mind's eye, I just started filling in all these gaps. And so I didn't, when I originally saw this, feel like I was missing anything, because I felt like this was like 10, 15, 20 years after the cartoon, and everything had changed, because it had just been open warfare for years. So in the film, we don't want to get into spoilers here just real quick. So, and this is the non-spoiler portion. So let me just say, I didn't have any issues really with the changes, and I actually liked a lot of the new characters they introduced. I will say that even the first time I saw it, I was impressed with Dolph Lundgren's earnestness as He-Man. And I was genuinely just floored by Frank Langella's performance. I really felt like that they had given us kind of a more, I'm going to use the term adult, right? Because I feel like this was made for all audiences, and they also packaged this for parents to watch, right? And I felt like they really gave us a really interesting, older kind of, he's been through this a thousand times before version of Skeletor. And I loved Frank Langella's performance, which is why I started off by using one of his lines. He's got so many great lines in this movie, and Frank Langella's delivery is so great. Started the show off with, "I must possess all or I possess nothing." That's such a great line. And that's so Skeletor. That's the thing too. That is so Skeletor. So I just remember completely loving it and was intrigued by how it, I felt like that they were taking the fantasy elements of He-Man, leaning into the science fiction elements a little bit more than actually the cartoon did, and almost kind of like giving us a Star Wars version of He-Man. That's what it felt like to me. And so I just thoroughly loved it and was genuinely impressed. And I've loved this movie ever since. And then when you look at, I remember even back then just being impressed by the incredible design work, the makeup, the score by Bill Conti is so great. Look at this Drew Struzan poster, everybody. This thing is killer. I mean, yeah. Just amazing. Absolutely amazing stuff. So I just was just like, wow, this is impressive. And to me, all it did was further increase my appreciation and love for the Masters of the Universe and He-Man and the incredible world that they built with creating all these crazy toys and all these vehicles. And I was just like, wow, there's so much potential here. So I just loved it. And
I did want to mention, Dave, because you did call out, you know, specifically Skeletor, you know, and the wonderful performance, you know, that Frank did, you know, in performing Skeletor. I do remember one of the things as a kid is that I felt, you know, in most cartoons of the era, and the Filmation He-Man was no exception. A lot of times I felt like the villains almost became buffoonish because they always lost. You pretty much knew that they were always going to lose. And I didn't like that. You know, I was a big fan of the G.I. Joe comics. And in the G.I. Joe comics, it's not like the good guys always won. It was much more dynamic. Transformers comics were really dark sometimes. And the Autobots did not always win at all. And so I was familiar with these other interpretations of the characters. And I kind of liked the fact when you kind of mixed it up, when sometimes the bad guys actually did kind of win, at least for a little while. And that wasn't the case usually in the cartoons. So that was one thing I remember that really stuck out to me as a kid, was like you said, right off the bat, it's like, it looks like Skeletor has won, you know? And I was like, okay, this is interesting. You know, like right off the bat, even as a kid, I remember thinking that. And it was just like, in a lot of ways, to me, it was like a breath of fresh air, even as a kid.
And I love, too, again, the performances and how incredible they are, particularly among our villains. You know, again, the opening scene, Skeletor is storming into the castle, Evil-Lyn's there, they've got the soldiers with them, and Evil-Lyn has...
And the score.
The score is so great.
That score, I remember that. Hitting me as a kid, that theme they came up with for Skeletor was just amazing as a kid. I remember it was just like, wow, you know what I mean? Like, wow.
Yeah. And, you know, there's that moment where Skeletor is walking right up to this throne. You know, he's going to take his seat. It's his, right? And Evil-Lyn says, after all these years, Grayskull is ours. And he turns, he's like, no. And he sits down and he gets kind of quiet and you see him grip that Havoc staff and he says, mine. And I was just like, wow, this is incredible. I mean, I just remember as a He-Man fan, I loved with what Frank Langella did with Skeletor and the stakes. This film has so much stakes. So I have, like I said, ever since the first time I saw it, I loved it. I loved it. Thought it was incredible. And it's been one of my favorite go-to movies. This film is often on in the studio at least once a year. And part of the reason I still collect He-Man things, part of the reason is because of this film. And I'm going to go ahead and throw it out there. Our next episode is going to be a He-Man collectors focused episode. So hopefully those of you who are watching and bopping in and out and leaving, hope you'll join us back for next Thursday's episode at 7 o'clock. We'll be talking about some of our He-Man collectibles we have in our collection and talking about some fun stuff, I think, anyway. All right. So we talked about how we first heard about it, and we talked about how we felt about it back in the day. We do have some...
Dave, let's get caught up with the Rose Gallery real quick. So John McClay had a couple comments, and he said, some of the first characters I really started drawing were from He-Man. And he also goes on to say, I think this film started me crushing on Courtney Cox. And it's funny because, I'm keep wondering when it comes to Courtney Cox, and Dave, maybe you remember this better. And I probably should have just looked this up because then I could give a sort of definitive answer. Do you remember if Courtney Cox had started appearing in Family Ties yet when came out?
That's an interesting question. And I honestly can't remember. I know the first thing I remember seeing Courtney Cox in was that Bruce Springsteen video.
Yeah. That's what I always hear about is that that's what they knew her from. In other words, that's pretty much why she got the part. Where she was known from. But in my mind, I feel like she had already been on Family Ties. But I think I might be wrong about that. Sometimes I think, especially when you're trying to remember stuff as you know when you were younger, things get a little bit cross. Because for me, Courtney Cox was always that girl on Family Ties. Basically, in my mind, Alex Keaton's second girlfriend. I know for everybody else, she's from, you know, she's the, you know, from Friends, but that's how I always identify her. I remember, you know, growing up as she was Alex Keaton's, you know, second girlfriend.
Yeah. And for me, in all honesty, this film is what really made me notice her. I do remember having seen her on Family Ties, but this film is what really kind of put her kind of on my radar anyway. And I really kind of noticed her in things actually from this film on. That's how it worked actually for me. So we talked about how we first heard about it. We talked about how we felt about it back in the day. Last part of our retrospective is going to be talking about how we feel about the film today, having recently revisited it. So I want to encourage you again, if you're in the Rogues Guide for watching the show, please comment from wherever you are. It doesn't matter if it's Facebook, Twitch, Twitter, wherever it is. Put your comment up in the Rogues Gallery. We'll be happy to put your comments up here on the show. We want to know, again, too, if for some, you know, again, tell us how you first heard about it. I would really, really find that interesting. But now we're going to go ahead and talk about how we felt about the film having recently revisited it. Eric and I did both recently rewatch Masters of the Universe specifically for today's show so that we would have fresh thoughts about it. All right. So why don't you go ahead and go first, Eric. Tell us how you feel about the film having recently rewatched it.
Well, first of all, I'd like to mention how I watched it. I do own a copy of this film. I do have it on DVD. And this is an old copy. It's like the old paper style, you know, DVD covers that you really don't see anymore, the sort of cheaper, almost disposable kind of covers. But this does sit proudly in my small collection of physical media. I don't have a lot of DVDs. I mention that on the show all the time. So this is always very high praise when I can show somebody, hey, I have a physical copy of this, because that's how much it means to me. But that's not how I watched it. I went ahead and saw it on Pluto TV. I found out that Pluto TV was streaming it for free. Part of why we do, you know, the Rogues retrospective on, you know, noon Pacific time, you know, is because on Sunday is if you want, maybe you can watch this film after our review. You know, maybe you're trying to enjoy your Sunday. Maybe you needed a break from the Olympics coverage right now, and you just want to do something different. And you can watch the film, you know, later today, you know, on your lazy Sunday afternoon. So I saw it on Pluto TV. So that does mean that it had commercials and things like that. I've actually mentioned in the past, like with Tubi, I sometimes get annoyed about where they actually do the breaks. And Pluto is no different when it comes to that comparison. It's very much like TV. They do the breaks at very odd times. But for me, it didn't take away the enjoyment of the film. I still thought it looked, you know, it looked decent. It looked okay. So just want to put that it is available on Pluto. And that's why I watched it last night. And I did watch it again just last night. Now, I should also mention that Master of the Universe is not one of those films unlike a lot of the films that we review when it comes to the Rogues retrospective, older films. This is not a film that's been out of circulation for me for a long time. In fact, Comet, which is a over-the-air, you know, network, basically like a digital sub-channel that a lot you'll get in most major markets. They've been showing Master of the Universe quite a bit over the last like 2 years, I would say, something like that, at least over like the last year. Within the last couple of months, they haven't been showing it, but it was in high rotation on Comet. And it was funny because even though I've seen this movie many times, every time it would come on, you know, I would just start watching it, you know, like wherever it was at, like because I didn't plan to watch it, but I'd be channel surfing and I'd be like, oh, it's on Comet, so I'm going to watch it, you know? So I have watched this film quite a few times, and even, you know, fairly recently, even besides what I did for the review where I watched it again last night, just to keep it even more fresh in my mind. So it's something that's kind of almost like constant where I watch it a lot. And it's one of those films, you know, that I just pick up and go with it. It's nonstop action. It doesn't even really matter, like if you miss like the first half of it or something like that. You can get into it right away. That's kind of the interesting thing about this movie. In a lot of ways, even though I don't feel like it's necessarily a perfect adaptation of the Filmation series, I do think that's interesting how you and I, Dave, we kind of view it differently. Whereas you see it as sort of the culmination of the Filmation series, I just think I see it much more as its own thing. And that's the way I was as a kid. And that's the way I am with it now. Like I definitely, because of the absence of a lot of characters, that's probably my main criticism of this film, by the way. And also some of the reimagining of some of the characters. I mentioned specifically Teela. I'm still disappointed. You know, with not that I think Teela did a bad job, not that I think the actress did a bad job, not that I think that she doesn't work or anything like that, but the outfit, you know, for one thing, that was always disappointing for me as a kid, and still disappointing. Same with the sorceress, you know, those kind of things, they still stick out to me. But the other part, of course, that sticks out to me is the lack of so many of Skeletor's henchmen, you know, not being in the film. And it's interesting because, you know, in terms of a lot of the behind the scenes information that I've gotten since then, it's interesting to find out why that happened. And the information that I got was that basically there was a real concern, you know, on the part of Mattel, there was a real concern about killing off characters. And in order for the film to have a little bit more freedom, they decided to invent some characters because that way, if they had their own characters that were unique to the film, they could do whatever they wanted with them. And it didn't necessarily affect the Filmation cartoon or anything like that, or any of the toys or any of Mattel's projects going forward. It was kind of its own thing, you know? So to me, that's still something that sticks out a little bit, but I do enjoy a lot of the new characters as well. Like the new henchmen, that Skeletor has that basically only appear in this movie. I do think that they're pretty interesting. The one that really sticks out to me, especially today, and I don't think as much when I first saw it, is Anthony DeLongis. Okay, and if you don't know the name. You may know the face. You may have heard of him. You may have seen of him. He plays Blade in the movie, and that is one of the new characters. And also one of the few new characters that actually got an action figure at the time. I remember that distinctly, that Blade actually got his own action figure. And he's the guy who wields like two swords. He was actually one of like the stuntmen. And I don't know, and I'm sure you knew this, Dave, but he was actually like the stuntman for Frank Langella. So in addition to being one of the principal actors and he actually having lines and being, you know, a kind of an important side character, he was actually a stuntman, and he's very well known in Hollywood for his swordplay work. I thought that was really interesting. So he in particular was a really interesting addition to me. I did like the fact that they had Beastman. I remember, you know, even as a kid being like, oh, Beastman, they have this, their own interpretation of Beastman that I thought was interesting. And, you know, this film has a lot going for it. It really does. Even with the quips and quibbles that I might have of various things that I felt weren't like cartoon accurate or toy accurate or whatever, I really feel like, you know, it stands really well on its own as its own thing. You know, that's the angle that I come from it at, you know, and to this day, like I said, anytime it comes on the TV, I start watching it.
Well, to quote Blade, she's mine. All right. So I love Anthony DeLongis in this as Blade. He was one of my favorite of the new characters too, Eric. I love the fact that he used two swords. And again, going back to how I viewed this when I originally saw it, the way that they set this up, it's like that, you know, they have been fighting for a long time. And one of the first things that Blade says to He-Man is, I've waited a long time for this. So
I think as a kid, I was kind of taken aback by that, by the way. I was like, wait a second.
Yeah. Well, again, for me, the way I was viewing this film right after it starts off, you know, at the beginning, like I said, I just, when I originally saw it, I saw this film as the end, like this is how it ends. And it's interesting. Yeah,
I actually really like that. I think it's really interesting. The fact that we kind of viewed it through different lenses, you know? And I think all this like headcanon that you put into it is really cool, honestly. All this world building that you put into it, I think is really cool.
So let me also say, having recently revisited this is a film, like I said again, I watch this film fairly frequently. Like I said, it's on in the studio at least once a year. It's one of those movies that I love it because of the mix of like fantasy elements with sci-fi elements. And I always felt like that of all the properties that have been collecting dust, that I felt like something amazing could be done with it. He-Man was one of those properties. I remember going and seeing the Lord of the Rings films and like going, man, if you did, the mix of the Lord of the Rings kind of idea with a Star Wars kind of thing, like, man, this could be so great. And I've always been surprised that they have had so many issues getting Master of the Universe back to the big screen. I've always been kind of surprised at that. So having recently revisited this, my opinions about this film have not really changed. Frank Langella's performance as Skeletor is still so great. I would put it up there with some of my other favorite villain performances of all time. He goes on the same shelf as Max von Sydow as being the Merciless. Another truly great, in my mind, villain performance. Like, Max von Sydow actually elevates that film because of his performance. I feel like Frank Langella actually elevates this film because of his performance. His performance, and again, like I said, with Dolph Lundgren's earnestness as He-Man, you know, just really makes you buy in that they are those characters from the cartoon come to life, in my mind anyway. It just works between those two. And when you look at the incredible art direction and design work, I think the biggest thing I would single out is sort of like, I never really cared for it and I still don't kind of care for it, is the redesign of Castle Grayskull on the exterior shots. I love the interior shots. The interior shots are amazing with all the platforms and everything. But I've never been a big fan, actually, of the exterior shot that they show us at the beginning when you get the opening narration, you know, where they talk about, you know, at the corner between the light and the dark stands Castle Grayskull. You know, I could actually do that whole opening thing for you. I've heard it so many times. And I just, you know, when I rewatching this film today, I just fall into the same place. I love it. And what's interesting is when you watch it with a critical eye and you think about that everything that happened, you can see where, for example, Gruldor in an early draft was supposed to be Orko. There's one particular line in particular, and let's do it. Could you put the spoiler warning up, Eric?
Yeah, absolutely. All right, we're getting into spoiler territory, folks.
Yeah, so if you haven't seen this film, and if you want to watch it, definitely go over to Pluto, check it out. Let me just go ahead and say right now, I think if you've never seen this film, you're going to enjoy this more than Revelation. There's a great line that clearly was originally written for Orko, where they're in the castle, Skeletor's troops have showed up, and the heroes were trying to free Sorceress, and it's not going very well. Where, you know, Dolph Lundgren has that line, "It's always been between us." You know, it's just this really great kind of confrontation, and they start fighting, and the Man-at-Arms says, you know, "Gruldor, can that thing get us out of here?" And he's like, "Yeah, but where? Where?" He's like, "I don't care, anywhere." And so he starts dialing up these coordinates, and then the door opens. And I feel like that originally this might have been just a magical artifact, and maybe Orko was somehow channeling magic through it, because right after that he says, "He-Man, Man-at-Arms, Teela, I did it, I did it." And that to me sounds like an Orko line, because his magic often didn't work. So I feel like that when you look at Gruldor, Gruldor is obviously meant to be a stand-in for Orko, but I think originally Gruldor was written as Orko, and then they changed it. And I feel like that's one of the lines that still left.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, because, you know, Orko was in fact from a different universe. Right. So, you know, where everything basically worked on, it was almost like a bizarro world where everything was kind of reversed. That's why his powers, right, didn't work very well in Eternia, because in, you know, Orko's world, he was a great magician. You know, his powers worked very well, right? And of course, he had like an amulet, and that was how he was able to travel to Eternia in the first place, and then he lost it. And that's why his powers don't quite work right. So it would have actually made perfect sense to have Orko. What I always hear about the Orko thing is that the bottom line was it would have been too expensive to actually have, you know, Orko floating around. So they had to figure a different path.
And that's probably one of the biggest things looking at this film from a critical lens from, you know, 2021, looking back at a film from 87, is they did the best with the money that they had. But I feel like that's also a valid criticism. There are clearly sequences where if they'd had a little bit more money, I think they would have done something a little bit more epic, because the film has so much scale and is so epic. And there are a few particular sequences, particularly going to the end of the film, for example, where you can tell that they were hampered by the budget. Because I know that they were racing to get this film finished before Canon Films just pulled the plug on this thing altogether. Final fight.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. You can definitely see it. And I'm sure you're familiar with the story, Dave, you know, of what happened. Basically did get shut down on set, like literally in the middle of the climax, in the middle of the final fight. Literally, Canon came down and shut down the production. Literally.
And it's interesting, too, because Bill Stout, William Stout, who was one of the designers and artists who worked on this film, a lot of the stuff that we see on screen, a large portion of it is basically his handiwork. And I've seen interviews with him where he talks about how when he designed the interior set for Castle Grayskull, the whole idea was that they would be able to take advantage of all these platforms and levels in order to have a really super epic fight between He-Man and Skeletor for the final battle. And then, of course, we didn't really get that because basic canon came in and shut the film down. So they had to kind of rush to put something together to actually finish the film, which I feel like is a bit of a shame, but it doesn't hurt the film. The film is definitely worth watching. So
I remember as a kid being really taken aback by the final fight between Skeletor and He-Man. And I remember even as a kid kind of thinking in my head, something along the lines of like, why do filmmakers always have to be so pretentious and kind of weird? Because I was kind of familiar with that concept of when a film becomes a little bit artsy fartsy. And I was just like, why do they always have to do weird stuff like that? Little did I know it was because they got shut down and they had to send everybody home. And that's why they filmed up that way. So to do with artsy fartsy, it was never intended to be that way. They simply got shut down and basically at the end of production, and they had to shoot it that way. There was no other way to shoot it.
Yeah, and it's one of the things about the film that I do feel like doesn't live up to the epic nature, especially when you hear that line and He-Man says, "Enough talk," and Skeletor says, "Yes, let this be our final battle," and they clash weapons, and then you go to that sort of more, you know, tight in, you know, black backdrop, you know, lens flary, whatever, which they had to do that because that was the only way that they could actually get the final fight in camera in order to finish the film, because they basically had no money. So,
yeah, it's such a crazy story. Because I always thought, you know, especially as a kid, that that was a conscious decision on their part. And I was all like, geez, why do they do that? You know? That's the reason.
Well, I can't recommend this film enough. If you're a Master Universe fan, I'm going to tell you right now, if you watch Revelation and Revelation did not do it for you, now is the time to revisit this film in my mind. Because as I said earlier, I have always felt this film as sort of the final battle between He-Man and Skeletor. That's the way I've always viewed this film. And so I never really needed an ending to the He-Man, you know, kind of story or legacy, because to me, the Masters Universe film is the end. And plus also, when this film came out, you know, this was towards the waning years of He-Man's popularity anyway. So to me, this very much is how the battle, the story between He-Man and Skeletor ends. It's always been that to me. And I have always just absolutely loved it. The thing with this film that I felt like, especially in hindsight, as I've gotten older, when I think back on this film where it's on in the studio, and I'm always genuinely impressed again with how well this film comes off. Again, that's just my opinion. That Master Universe has an incredible amount of potential to be brought back live action to the big screen and be as epic and grand and as impressive as something like Star Wars, as something like Lord of the Rings. Now, the damage that's been done, I feel like that ship has now sailed, but we'll be getting into that soon enough. And again, that's also just my opinion. But I'm going to go ahead and recommend, check it out on Pluto if you don't own a copy of this. I definitely think this film is worthwhile. I love this film. I've always loved this film. I can't recommend this film enough. Just on the strength of Langella's performance alone. So definitely, I highly recommend you go check out Master Universe. What do you say, Eric?
I love this film as well. And again, it's kind of funny because Dave and I are coming from different angles. We're kind of coming from to the same conclusion, but in kind of a different way. You know, whereas Dave, you know, has this really cool way of fitting it in with the Filmation cartoon, I really see it as its own thing. And I lament the fact that we never got a sequel. And to kind of support where I'm coming from, this is the origin of the after credit scene, as far as I know. I don't really remember a movie doing an after credit scene. So way before the MCU started doing an after credit scene, when after credit scenes were just not a thing, they did not exist, they do an after credit scene on this film. And I've always thought it was so classic. In fact, I've always had this dream of doing my own films, and every film I do, and same way as the Masters of the Universe, just randomly, every single one ends with cutscene. And I'm not going to spoil that one for you, because I just think you gotta wait to the end if you've never seen it, because there might be some of you that have seen and don't realize there is an after credit scene on the particular movie. So check it out, because I missed it the first time because I just walked out of the theater, you know, as the credits roll, I normally did when I was a kid. And I found out later in the paper that this film does indeed have a cut scene. And it makes me really wish that they had been able to particular version of Masters of the Universe, which of course happened now. But I agree with Dave that this film does show the potential of a live action Masters of the Universe. And I did do some research, and man, that project has been stalled like crazy. I mean, they were supposed to be coming out with a new Masters of the Universe live action movie basically like this year. And things have just continually gone into basically production hell on that project. So, and interestingly enough, Dave, one thing I heard that one of the pitches, they thought it was too epic because basically they said it was very much like Lord of the Rings. And Sony apparently owns the rights at this point for a live action He-Man. And they were like, it's just too ambitious. And they decided they had to rework it. So definitely, I think this film does show the potential of a Masters of the Universe live action film. And I really wish they'd been able to continue this version. I really do, because there's just so many good elements to it. You know, I would love to see Dolph Lundgren back as He-Man. I would love to see Frank Langella back as Skeletor. But, you know, let's be honest, they're getting up there at this point.
Well, and what's interesting about this film, too, I have always heard these rumors. And whenever I watch it, I don't see it. But I have always heard that Canon Films commissioned actually a script for a sequel to this movie. And it somehow they repurposed it and reworked it, and it became the Van Damme film Cyborg, when I rewatched Cyborg, I don't understand what in the hell it was that they supposedly kept. It doesn't make any sense to me.
That sounds like a Hollywood legend to me, Dave.
Yeah, it's just I don't know how that would. But I mean, you hear those rumors every once in a while, and I'm just like, how? No, there's no way. But supposedly, there you go. That's what I've heard, but I don't get it.
Yeah, this film, you know, it was not a big hit at the time. Just there's no other way to slice it. But I do think it has gained even more than a cult following at this point. I think a lot of people appreciate this film now.
Yeah. Like I said, my appreciation for this film has only increased. And as I get older, like I said, for me, this is how my Masters Universe journey ends. You know, this is how it ends. So I didn't really need anything beyond this. But if they wanted to bring it back to the big screen, I'd love to see it. But like I said, for me, this is how the story ends. So I've never really needed anything really beyond this. All right, so let's. What do we want to do next, Eric? Because I do want to talk about Revelation.
Well, I think you should go right into it. I just think you should get right into it.
Okay, here we go. Let's just go ahead and get into it. I don't have a specific graphic prepared for Revelation, but I'm going to go ahead and get into this. So, let me start off by saying I'm going to have probably a little bit of a controversial point of view for this. I feel like at the end of the day, the biggest problem with Revelation is the absolutely horrendous attempt to do damage control in this series. The damage control to me is the thing that is absolutely killing this thing more than anything else. And let me also say that it's gotten to the point now that I feel like that there's some gamesmanship going on with this, and I'm starting to feel like we're being played. Now, there's this old adage in Hollywood, any press is good press, any press, right?
Publicity is good publicity.
Yeah, there you go. Any publicity is good publicity, okay? And I have this feeling that we are being played. Kevin Smith is smart enough, in my mind, to know better than to say some of the stuff that he's been saying. That's just my personal opinion. I could be totally wrong. And I feel like that there is an angle on this where they are leaning into this and making this worse because it's helped creating more noise for the series so that more people might potentially check it out on Netflix. I feel like that we are all getting played with all this stuff. So I don't want to spend too much time talking about Revelation because I feel like we're being played. So let me just put that out there right now. I watched all five episodes on Friday night, and then I watched the Revelation after show on Saturday. And here's the thing. It's okay. That's my entire review. It's okay. I don't think it's great. I also don't think it's the worst thing I've ever seen in my life. It's just, okay, whatever. That's my official official review for it, because I look at it as, you know, fan fiction. Like a really weird attempt at fan fiction, because it's just like that stuff back in the day when the internet was new and someone would write this crazy like pitch for a show and the main character. Oh, we got the spoiler graphic up. Spoilers, everybody. I'm about to get knee deep into Revelation. So if you haven't seen it, let me just tell you, I don't know if you want to bother, go watch the movie. But it's just like that fan fiction where they kill the main character, right? And these side characters who, while important to the story, were never the lead character or said in the lead character. Let me also confirm that this is the Teela show. It totally is the Teela show. Clownfish was totally right about that. It is definitely the Teela show. And there are portions of it that I was genuinely impressed with. The intro is kind of neat because they use a lot of the original packaging art. The art direction on it's really cool because they're so faithful to a lot of the toy designs for the vehicles. The animation is really great. The score by Bear McCreary, who I'm a fan of. I'm a big fan of Bear McCreary. Score's pretty good. You can tell that there was some care and there are fans that were working on this when you look at it. That being said, at the end of the day, a show that basically manages to kill Adam twice, I can't endorse. The fact that they actually, and here's the thing that I do find a little annoying, is the fact that Kevin Smith bragged about the fact that he managed to kill Adam twice. Now, you know, the fact that they somehow managed to kill Orko at the same time. It is not great.
Jeez.
But there are some interesting ideas. But at the end of the day, it's not enough for me to come back to it. And here's the big thing. When I look at what's going on with the press and the publicity, and here's the, and this is weird. They only put half this show out. I've never seen Netflix do that before. They put five episodes out, and apparently, I guess there's another five episodes to come or something. I don't know.
Well, technically, they did that with Unsolved Mysteries. So
right, okay, okay.
Unsolved Mysteries did that as well. I mentioned that because we've actually reviewed the Netflix Unsolved Mysteries on this show. We've reviewed some episodes. So to be fair, yes, they have. It's okay. It's not an unprecedented thing.
And I had forgotten about that, Eric. Thank you for pointing that out. But there is a really good chance, and this is why I feel like we're being played. I feel like we're being played because I feel like the second half of this is going to walk most of this back. And if it doesn't walk most of this back, I feel like that one of the He-Men of old, someone like Hero or something, is going to come back and basically become either the new He-Man. And I would also not be surprised if in the last five episodes that somehow She-Ra shows up and She-Ra saves the day. So I'm not a fan of what they did. But when I look at it with a critical eye, when you look at the animation, when you look at the quality of a lot of the character design stuff, there are some interesting ideas in it. It's okay, you know, but I can't recommend it saying it's great. I'm just going to say it's okay. To me, it was like watching Black Widow. It was the same thing. It's all right. You know, I mean, if you want to watch it, it's okay. But I could also see, too, if you're a diehard He-Man fan and you want a continuation, I could see where this thing would make you so mad that you want to, you know, break your television in half, because some of the stuff they do is intentionally meant to elicit an emotional reaction, which leans into the fact that I feel like we're being played. Because I just can't see it. I can't, and maybe I'm wrong, but I just can't see Mattel, Hasbro, whoever the heck it is. I can't see them wanting to put out that many toys and products with He-Man all over it and then kill He-Man that many times and have him absent for most of the show. I don't understand what I'm looking at. So it makes me think that there is something else going on. So I'm just going to say, I feel like we're being played. My review is, eh, it's okay. I will not be back for the second half because I've got more important things to do. And there you go. And for me, the Master Universe film we just talked about, that's how my He-Man story ends, everybody. And I'm perfectly okay with that. I don't need to come back for the second season. I know how the final battle goes down. And it's led by incredible performances like Frank Langella as Skeletor and Dolph Lundgren as He-Man. And I'm good. I don't need to go watch the second half of this thing. I got other things I got to do. So that's my whole deal. I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about Revelation because, like I said, it just feels like they're playing us, Eric. It feels like we're being played.
No, I think you've hit the nail on the head. And I do want to just give my perspective, as fairly quickly. We are over the hour mark at this point, and there is one more segment at least that I wanted to get to that's in the description. I do want to talk about the District 9 sequel, District 10. But here's the thing, okay? And you've hit a lot of these points, Dave. You've actually kind of hit a lot of these things, but you know, you took a different path than what I'm taking. I'm not going to watch it, okay? I did consider watching it because sometimes I hear that criticism in my ear of, well, how can you criticize something you've never seen, okay? Well, for one thing, I'm not really criticizing it because I haven't seen it, okay? But I can tell you why I'm not going to watch it. I can tell you why I'm not going to watch it, okay? Because I know, and I knew from, we covered this in our news segment, we knew this was going to be a bait and switch. And we knew how disingenuous Kevin Smith actually is. And I've felt this for a long time about the guy, okay? Kevin Smith is one of those guys that has this quote unquote, like amazing, like nerd cred or something like that, because he legitimately liked some stuff that a lot of fans like Star Wars. Okay. It seems like these days, if you like Star Wars, somehow that immediately makes you part of the club and everything is forgiven. You know, that even includes, like, I could think of like JJ comes into my mind, JJ Abrams. Oh, I love Star Wars, so I can ruin Star Trek, you know? That's fine. I can make Star Trek into Star Wars because I like Star Wars and I'm one of you. And I hate that stuff. I absolutely hate that stuff because that's the way Hollywood treats these properties. Basically, they're like, it's genre entertainment. It's fantasy or sci-fi. These are the lowest forms of life as far as Hollywood is concerned. So we don't have to care how we treat these properties. I believe 100% that's the way Hollywood has been forever. You know, the one exception, and even now it seems like it's under assault, is Lord of the Rings. You know, Lord of the Rings did get some actual Academy Awards and things like that. And I've always heard it's because they employed so many people. And Hollywood felt they needed to give them a reward for that, even though they hate fantasy and they hate sci-fi and they think it's all trash. And you can just listen to some of even the top directors who've done some of the, you know, greatest movies, quote, of all time. They think this stuff is trash. Comic book movies aren't real cinema. They say stuff like that all the time, okay? It's all just genre to them. And so they can insert a guy like Kevin Smith, who is not a fan of He-Man and never was a fan of He-Man, and give this to him and then give him that bait and switch cred that, oh, no, no, I did like He-Man. Remember, I'm your friendly nerdy geek guy. I'm that guy, right? So I can make this movie and you're going to be happy and I'm going to be faithful to the source material and you're going to enjoy this. And it's totally what you wanted. It's a continuation filmation cartoon. And we always knew it was not going to be that. Ever since Clownfish came out and said that, we've known this for a long time. Okay. And when I first started hearing these leaks, I was like, I'm not going to participate. I'm not going to play. I'm not going to play ball. Just keep in mind, all Netflix cares about is how many views they get. Okay, they don't care whether you like it or not. I don't think they even care if you put a thumbs up or a thumbs down. I really don't. They care about how many views they get. And because of all the attention and the quote-unquote controversy, they're getting views. People become curious. I even feel that, Paul. I'm curious. But you know what? I already know that they killed Adam because Kevin Smith already went on online and told me that. Kevin Smith did. When the show hasn't been out like 24 hours and he's out there already putting the spoilers out. So I definitely think we're being played. I definitely think it's like, if you want to get off this crazy train, people are going to have to stop supporting this stuff and stop watching it. And maybe even I'll even go so far as to stop talking about it, because this is you're exactly right, Dave. We are being played. Hollywood does look at it this way. All publicity is good publicity. And in the age of the Stream Wars, a view is a view, whether you say you like it, whether it gets a terrible review on Rotten Tomatoes. Kevin Smith has been out there saying, oh, who cares? What about critics? All that kind of stuff. They don't care. They do not care. It's a completely different ball game for them. And it's, hey, people are talking about it, and that's all they care about. That's all they care about. They don't care whether you like it. They don't care about any of that stuff. A view is a view as far as they're concerned. And I really think you're right, Dave. They're probably trying to put people on the hook so they can get them again. You know, and there's that old saying, you know, that I remember so well from Star Trek, right? You know, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. That's right. The bottom line for me. That's the bottom line for me. And I have been fooled so many times. I mean, that's a big reason why we've changed the format of this show. That's why we're not reviewing very much modern stuff anymore. Not to say we never will. You know, Dave did a review of The Tomorrow War not too long ago. So there are exceptions to the rule. But for the most part, for me especially, I'm done. It's very hard for me to get into something new at this point because I know where they're going. I know what they're doing, and I'm not aboard with the agenda. I'm just not getting on board. And the way Kevin Smith has conducted himself is just pathetic. And I hope people are starting to really see the shill that he is. Yes, the shill. And what I mean by a shill is he pretends to be a fan and he isn't. That's what a shill is. You pretend that you're a fan. You pretend that you're somebody that's really into this, and you're not. You're not. You're just a corporate shill. You just, whatever they tell you to say, you go out there and say it. And I find it very hard to believe that Kevin Smith isn't doing what he's doing without some direction from the studio. I find it very hard to believe he's just going off rogue on his own and causing this train wreck. I mean, this absolute train wreck of bad publicity and bad conduct and blaming the fans. I am so sick of blaming the fans, the fact that you can't respect continuity. You can't be honest. You know, look at this movie that we were just reviewing. Okay. And Dave, you and I have talked about this and this absolute crap revisionism that came from Sarah Michelle Gellar. Okay. I have a quote from Sarah Michelle Gellar, where she talks about basically that the He-Man show never had a character. There was no way into that story for me growing up because all of the women were afterthought characters. They didn't hold the power, and the storylines weren't about them. Look at this movie. Look at this movie, okay? Teela is in it. Teela is important, is in it? The sorceress is in it. The sorceress is important in this. And they have a new character, Courtney Cox, a female character for this movie, okay? This narrative that they keep putting out is bull. It's absolute bull, and it's revisionism. This is full. Even here on the picture, you can see Courtney Cox is right there on the cover. Right there on the cover. No stories about women, right? I rest my case.
Yeah, and that's kind of where we are, everybody. I don't want to talk about Revelation anymore on the show, you know, because I feel like that we're all being played, and I don't feel like it's worthy of continuing to talk about. If you came to the show late and you're curious to hear my views on the show, because I did take the bullet, I did watch it for the show, just in case anyone wanted to talk about it, I want to be prepared to discuss it, so I did. But other than that, I'm done. Watch the replay, listen to the podcast, and you can hear what I had to say about it.
And there's plenty of spoiler reviews out there, by the way, which also kind of annoys me. As recent as it has been, it's hard to find like a non-spoiler review, just a simple thumbs up or thumbs down. You know what I mean? Did you like it or did you not? What do you think? Because we know people's creds a lot of times. We know where they're coming from, especially commentators, because you know they have other material out there. And sometimes I just want to know the opinion of someone who's watched it, who I know is an actual He-Man fan or has some real He-Man knowledge, you know. And it gets frustrating because, hey, it doesn't even matter at this point because Kevin Smith already just put all out anyway in this crazy attempt at damage control, you know.
And the other thing too is there are some interesting ideas, but when you're talking about the conclusion, again, where it ends, I feel like that this story's kind of already been told. You know, the Master Universe movie that we're talking about, it ends with Skeletor going on, he gets the power of the universe, and then he says, what is the significance of you? Who are these people to me? You know, you are no longer my equal. I am a god. So where the show ends is nothing new. We've already seen it actually play out better in live action. So I just don't see the point in continuing down this road. Because to me, the movie,
check this out instead of Revelations. Yep. There you go.
Yep. That to me, that's how the story ends, everybody. And it's just been further reinforced. All right, very cool. With that, Eric, I think we're probably good talking about that. We are going to do, again, a Collector's Corner focused episode about Master Universe, because I do still like He-Man. I do still like Master Universe. But I'm going to be talking about my stuff I bought back in the day, some of my collectibles I still have, and talk about that for next episode. So I know, Eric, that we had some pop culture news. What did you have up for today's episode?
So I'd actually announced this for Thursday's episode. We just never got to it. It's funny how the news cycle is sometimes, especially with the Thursday show, because it's so much like a feast or a famine. Sometimes there's like nothing for pop culture news, and I'm struggling to just find anything. And other times there's a lot of stuff going on. You know, I will mention again, because we mentioned previously, the San Diego Comic-Con at home is still going on. I actually did go on the YouTube site and was kind of just checking stuff out. I'll tell you those numbers, Dave, for some of those panels are pretty laughable. They're pretty bad. So I don't know if anybody's even paying attention to San Diego Comic-Con at this point. I do hope that they do their physical event in November. But man, some of those numbers, even for some of the real popular stuff, you know, it's almost shocking. It's almost shocking how low some of those numbers are for the San Diego Comic-Con at home. But if there's some news coming out, go ahead.
And just let me say, I would have loved to have gotten that Walgreens exclusive Blade Funko Pop that looks like the Wesley Snipe one that's a part of the event. I have exhausted so much time trying to figure it out. I talked about it last episode, and I have been still continuing to try and figure out how to get it. I don't know how in the hell you're supposed to get it, so I just gave up again.
Yes, that happens a lot with these internet exclusives. You know, there's a lot of criticism of that these things just, they're not readily available. So this was something that I wanted to talk about, last Thursday. I just want to touch on it. So this is an IGN.com article. Again, it's a little bit older. It's dated July 20th. So 5 days ago as the time of this broadcast. Headline reads, District 10 will be based on a topic in American history. Quote, it took a decade to figure out to come up with the reason why to make that film as opposed to just make a sequel. So the article doesn't get that much farther into this. I think this headline says it all. And I've got alarm bells going off in my head all over the place. I'm going to start with the most controversial part of this that I'm just kind of sitting there scratching my head. It took a decade to figure out to come up with a reason why to make that film as opposed to just make a sequel. Am I taking crazy pills here, Dave, or did District 9 basically not end on a cliffhanger, essentially?
No, District 9 ended in pretty much a definitive manner where you didn't necessarily need a sequel.
Well, I disagree, okay, because I'll put up the spoiler warning for anybody who has seen or hasn't seen District 9. If you don't want to be spoiled, I'm putting up the spoiler warning right now, okay? The way District 9 ends, okay, is basically one of the aliens escape in the mothership, okay, clearly to get help, okay? The aliens are not in a good place, all right? And at the same time, the main character has been turned into an alien, okay? And that's and if that isn't a cliffhanger, I don't know what is, Dave. I mean, obviously we disagree on this point, but I think that it ended as a cliffhanger. It was always meant to have some sort of a sequel. So I just don't feel that this is a genuine comment, you know, that he's saying that I didn't want to do a sequel just to do it. It totally was set up for a sequel. It was totally set up for a sequel. It just did not in my mind. Okay. But to go on from this, okay. The biggest concern I have about this, besides the fact that I'm concerned in general these days about what Hollywood is going to do with this stuff, and District 9 very much is a political commentary. I mean, there's no doubt about that. District 9 is political commentary. It's very much, you know, supposed to be analogous to apartheid. There's no denying it. It's set in South Africa and all that kind of stuff. The aliens very much the way that many black people lived in South Africa during the era of apartheid. There's no denying that. It's definitely social commentary. The biggest thing that actually concerns me about this idea of the topic in American history is one of the things I really enjoyed about District 9 was the fact that it wasn't, LA wasn't getting invaded again. Because we see that all the time. First of all, you know, for Hollywood, LA literally is the center of the universe. Like literally. That's their mindset on everything. Everything is always California, LA centric. It's like the rest of the country, much less the rest of the world, doesn't exist to them. And it was kind of refreshing to me that District 9 took place in another country. And the aliens didn't come to California, as they so often do in pretty much every other single alien invasion movie. It's funny because even when you have like aliens coming to multiple cities, of course they have to go to Los Angeles too. I mean, that's just a given, you know, they just have to be there. Be just cause, you know, even though New York is the largest city in the United States and Washington, D.C. are the capital, they still have to somehow be in Los Angeles because, again, Los Angeles is the center of the universe. So one of the concerns that I have about this is whether that they might actually be changing the setting, because it does make sense that, you know, again, because I do feel that a sequel was set up, and I could definitely see a scenario where the alien returns, you know, the comes back, and he sets up shop somewhere else, you know, possibly in the United States. So I just kind of wanted to mention that because I think that's one aspect of it that a lot of people haven't talked about, because I personally really liked the fact that District 9 was set in a place outside of the United States and, more importantly, outside of California. So that's the angle that I'm coming from on this.
Well, I guess for me, when I saw District 9, in all honesty, Eric, I didn't feel like it really needed a sequel. So maybe that's just me. I mean, I could see what you're saying. I mean, it does end, again, we got the spoiler warning up down here. It does end with the main character turned into an alien, and we do have aliens going off to basically get help. But I guess for some reason in my mind, I just felt like District 9 was a totally closed off film. You know, like,
well, at least you're consistent, because you said the same thing about Master of the Universe. So
I did. Yeah. There are certain, it's weird with me because there are certain things that, in all honesty, sometimes when I watch it, I don't really feel like it needs a sequel. And then
just remember, yeah, after credit scene, there is, yeah, an after credit scene on this film on Masters of the Universe. That's what I'm holding up right now. So just remember, talking to the audience here, just remember there is an after credit scene.
I know. And Skeletor says, I'll be back. I know. But I'm just saying, for me, sometimes when I watch a film, I feel like, okay, well, you've said what you need to say. I don't feel like you need to I guess that's just me. So there you go. Yeah.
Alrighty.
Sorry about that. Yeah, I guess that's kind of the thing. I do like District 9, though. I have the Art of book over there. It's a really interesting film. And I said earlier that I was a Neil Blomkamp fan. I've enjoyed all of his films. A lot of his films have a political slant to them, in my mind. So,
oh, there's no denying that District 9 has a political slant. I don't have a problem, yeah, with that. I'm more concerned, yeah, about changing the setting because I'm sick. I'm sick of LA being the center of the universe. I'm absolutely disgusted with it. So,
well, there you go. There you go. All right. Very cool. I don't have anything pop culture-y. I feel like, you know, talking about that show I don't want to talk about anymore was kind of my pop culture-y thing. And again, the reason I don't want to talk about it is because I feel like we're being played. So that's why I don't want to talk about it.
I think you're 100% correct. 100% correct.
All right. Very cool. All right. Do you have anything else for this week, Eric, or is that good?
Yeah, that's all I got.
Okay, cool. And I do want to apologize. We had discussed in the last episode talking about Robotech. And then I guess it's kind of weird that the show that we were just talking about kind of popped up and kind of caught us a little bit by surprise. And I guess in my mind anyway, I didn't realize it was coming out as soon as it was. But again, I've been really crazy busy here at the studio. So, and we wanted to definitely talk about the Masters Universe film. So we decided to bump Robotech actually till next week. Right, Eric?
Yeah, we had actually previously stated that we were going to review the Masters of the Universe live action film.
Right.
When Revelations came out. We specifically made that statement. So, yeah, but it did sneak up on us. There's no doubt about it. It did sneak up on us.
Yeah. So the goal right now, unless things change, what we're looking at right now, our next two episodes coming up Thursday will be a Collector's Corner focused episode. I'm going to focus on He-Man and the Masters Universe, primarily talking about older toys and kind of things in my collection, and then talking about some of the comic book stuff and whatever, and a little bit different from what we normally do when we recommend things. I'm curious just to see what the value of some of the books and stuff are at the moment. And then I'll show off a few things actually in my collection as a part of the discussion. And then for Sunday's episode, Eric, we're still good. Actually, again, next Sunday, 12:05, we're still good to probably do Robotech, right?
Yeah, I'm good with that. Yeah, we're just going to be reviewing actually the first two episodes of Macross and doing a little bit of an overview of Robotech, and also talk a little bit about where the franchise stands these days.
Well, there you go. That sounds like a lot of fun. All right, cool. So unless anyone in the Rogues Gallery has anything else that they want to add, I think that's probably pretty good, and we'll just go ahead and move over to the outro.
Sounds good to me.
Very cool. All right. So I want to thank you for hopefully watching or listening to this episode of the Retro Rogues Live. Again, my name is Dave Beta. I've been one of your hosts. If you're curious to see what occupies a lot of my time, check out my t-shirt company, KirbyTees.com. It's KirbyTees.com. Got a lot of different things on there, as well as if you want, you could even order your own custom t-shirt actually through the website. But beyond that, I want to talk about a lot of the fun things we've got going on, such as Sarah Aerosmith's Brains Are Magic, the new Skeletor shirt, which is a brand new version of that on the website right now. And we also want to encourage you to check out the Retro Rogues Live t-shirts. We would greatly appreciate that if you would purchase one and support what we're doing here on the Retro Rogues Live. We greatly appreciate your support. Also, too, if you do enjoy the show, if you've enjoyed this conversation, you know, please consider actually telling your friends, family, maybe sharing the links and helping get the word out about the Retro Rogues Live. We would greatly appreciate that support as well. But enough about that. I want to thank my great co-host, Mr. Eric Alexander, for being on here. And as always, providing his unique perspective and point of view and all the different topics and things that we talk about here on the show. Eric, please tell the folks, hopefully watching or listening at home, where they can learn more about you on the interwebs.
Well, I'm most active on Twitter. You can reach me there at BassGod14, at BassGod14. My DMs are open, so you can always send me suggestions, rumors, news stories, anything you want us to talk about on the show. Always open for that. That is also the official YouTube and the official Twitch, so if you comment on there, more likely than not, I will be the one that responds to you. We don't have any new comments from the Rogues Gallery today, so with that, I'm just gonna leave that as the last word.
We want to thank you for listening to this episode of the Retro Rogues Live podcast. You can learn more about Eric Alexander and Five the Live Show on either Twitch, YouTube, or Twitter by searching for BassGod14. That's BassGod14 on either YouTube, Twitch, or Twitter. If you are curious about co-host Dave Beatty, you can see some of his art, find social media links, and so much more at his website, DaveBeatty.com. That's DaveBeatty.com. If you enjoyed this episode of the Retro Rogues Live, be sure to like, share, and subscribe.